And we've got a number, oops, I got the wrong sheet. Maybe I don't have our panelists. Oh, there they are, sorry. It's in a box, I didn't have you guys all broken. I thought there'd be like a paragraph like this. Understanding how Minnesota compares to other states helps us to size up our own problems, identify options and solutions. We're delighted to have with us some of the country's premier nonpartisan experts on state budgets, jobs, and tax structure. Only this group would be excited about those things. I don't think that you could convince a number of students in here to talk about tax structure and nonpartisan budgetary items. Scott Patterson, who is the executive director of the National Association of State Budget Officials, welcome up to the stage. One of our panelists, come on up. We also have with us Harley Duncan from KPMG, previous executive director of the Federation of Tax Administrators. Welcome. We're also pleased to have with us Inez Will, and I knew I was going to have a hard time with Wildwood, who chairs the Governor Dayton's Workforce Development Council. Their bios are in your folder. Please take a chance to review them. We'd rather hear their work and their discussion than take up time with bios, but they are very impressive. These are some of the premier experts across the country. We are very fortunate to have them here with us today. Scott, I invite you to kick things off with your presentation. Presenters are gonna, will last for about 40 minutes, half hour to 40 minutes. We'll leave 15 minutes for some discussion, and then after the presentations, after the speakers are done with their presentations, I'll help moderate some Q&A. So please take notes if you have, I think there's some cards up here as well for questions, but be preparing as you go along. We'll have a very, I would say, very spirited discussion afterwards, but we appreciate all the folks being here, and we'll get ready to go.
Well, thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be here again. I have to tell you, though, my track record is over because I've done this a few times and I really enjoy it. But every other time, I've had the luck of having the temperature in Washington, D.C. be colder than Minnesota. But unfortunately, that didn't happen this time. But I've got a bunch of slides. Some of them I'll go through very quickly. So if you do have a particular question of any kind, please grab me afterwards or perhaps in Q&A, there's time. But I just want to throw a bunch of information out to you to give you kind of a snapshot of where we are and how things fit with Minnesota. So we're going to start with the current fiscal situation and give you an overview. And the bottom line is what we're seeing across the country is improvement in revenue, in some cases quite significantly, but it's still not yet pre-recession levels. So I'll show you some slides to show that. And the spending pressures, particularly from healthcare, are enormous. And even with more money coming in, the demands for spending is higher for those dollars. Healthcare reform obviously is going to have an impact on states. And a lot of states, they're still in the process of trying to determine the pros, cons, benefits, and do estimating. So I think we still have a ways to go before we have a lot of good information on that. The final bullet here, though, I really want to emphasize, and I think you probably know this, but we're going to see limited federal funds. My view, and I really want to pass this on to you, is there is no alternative to the fact that over time, the federal government is going to decrease the amount of money coming to states and localities. I just see no other path. Now, the good part is, I don't think it'll be quite as dramatic as some think. I think it's more of a long-term incremental change, but I think we have to be ready for it. Now, I won't spend a lot of time on this. The bottom line is state and local employment has decreased by about 665,000 since the beginning of the recession. So we've had a lot of shedding of state and local jobs, with state employment shedding about 132,000 during the recessionary period, and well over 500,000 from the local governments. Now, what are the indicators? I thought you'd find this very interesting. The first is that, as you can see here, state budgets had outright declines during the recession. First time we'd ever seen it in the data. And now we're back to improvement year over year. This is spending. This is about 4% last fiscal year, and we're looking about 3% for this fiscal year, again, of state budget growth. Now, the interesting thing is that line is the average. That's 5.6% year-over-year average growth for decades for state budgets, for state spending. And this, to me, fits with the narrative of the new normal, that things are not going to be what we've seen in the past in terms of growth. We'll have growth, but it's not going to be as fast. And I know that a lot of your constituents are in the same boat. They're living this, and that's what we're predicting for state government. Again, the bottom line is state budgets have grown over the last couple of years during the severe part of the downturn, but they are not yet to the peak year of 08, fiscal year 08. The other thing is, and to me this is the most important slide I'm going to show you today, the bottom line is that right now, for this particular fiscal year 12, every new dollar is going to Medicaid. There are a few exceptions there. Now this is the national aggregate data we collected in December. Bottom line is, everything else is relatively flat. You see a little bit of a decline in higher ed support, a little bit of bump up in K through 12. But because the Recovery Act funds for Medicaid, that big bump up ended, and because enrollment for Medicaid and healthcare costs are going up, virtually every new dollar that states are having come in is going to Medicaid. And to me, again, that is one of the key things that people have to realize. When I saw one of the budget people yesterday, they said, you know, we're Minnesota, we've had 3M in Minnesota in the budget office. M stands for Medicaid, Medicaid, Medicaid. I thought that was an interesting way to say it. Revenue is coming back up. The percentages look pretty good, especially in contrast to the downturn. Again, that's exactly what you would expect. Now, I think I mentioned this last year, but I really want to emphasize this again because I think you're going to hear this. The percentage increases in revenue are going to sound pretty good because look how far those bars went down. The percentage improvement looks good. So your constituents are not always going to understand when they see some headline that revenue went up 12%, 8%, depending on the month or the year or the quarter. And I think it's really important to explain, yes, it's improving, but the base was low and the bills coming in are amounts much more than the amount of revenue coming in. And again, I really want to emphasize that. I think that's something you're going to deal with because I know other folks, other elected officials in other states have told me that's been a dilemma. It's one thing during the downturn to be able to say, well, you know, everything's going down. But now we're seeing revenue improvement. But again, it's not back to pre-recession levels. Now, Minnesota General Fund revenue, you're probably as familiar with these figures as I am. This is for our report, so the definitions differ a bit. The reason I tell you is these may not be exact to some of the figures you see, but the trends are the same. And just like every other state, you built up throughout the 2000s. You saw a dip and year-over-year revenue declined, and now you're back on the upswing, and you should be back to pre-recession levels fairly soon, if not this fiscal year, the next. Now, the other thing that's a good indicator I want to talk to you about briefly are balances. These are basically rainy day funds in the end of the year balances that states have. And they're running higher than you would expect. And I would look at just the green line. The reason is Texas and Alaska have such huge reserves, they kind of throw the aggregates off. But it's really important to realize that states do have some rainy day funds, and I think states have really learned the importance of these. Now, what's interesting, though, is there's kind of a have and have-nots. There are 20 states with close to zero in their rainy day fund. Now, what are we looking at in terms of balances as far as Minnesota? You all have, you're running pretty close to what we're seeing average nationally. I wanted to show you this compared to your neighbors. And again, I can get you these figures if you'd like. But the one thing I really want to emphasize is do not compare yourself to North Dakota. For many reasons, despite them being a neighbor, they are a total anomaly. And anyone who does that will become very depressed because you cannot be North Dakota. They are a very small populated state with very, very profitable oil and other extractions that are basically coming out of the ground. So again, I think it's interesting. Wisconsin has had close to a zero rainy day fund, and some of the other states, like Iowa, have had a little more healthy rainy day fund than Minnesota. Mid-year budget cuts are a great indicator of how the fiscal situation is in the states. And the good thing to show here is we've only had two states have to make some minor adjustments, Washington and Missouri, and everybody else is doing pretty well. And what's neat about that is that means you're not going back and cutting after the governor signed the budget, whereas 43 states had to do that in 10. So it's pretty, I'm sorry, 09 and then 39 and 10. So that kind of shows the trend. It's a good trend. Now, quick economic overview. Unemployment is going down. You have been below average, which is good, in terms of unemployment, compared to the national average, which is that blue. So that things, and that has improved, and I'm sure you keep an eye on unemployment statistics probably more than others even do. And then, again, I think it's kind of nice to, there are many states I go in and I show this slide and they're worse off than the national statistics, but you've consistently been below and had a better employment situation than a lot of other states. It's a nice place to be. Now, I want to show you this slide because this is underlying my North Dakota comment. The bottom line here is there are about 13 states that are extremely dependent on petroleum, oil, gas. They are going to live and die by the price of oil, and to some extent the price of gas. If you're not in that list, and you're not, you're dependent on the national economy, which is good. It means your economy is much more diverse. But the reason I show this, particularly to you all here, is it's why you can't compare yourself to North Dakota, because you are a diverse, larger economy that's going to be dependent on national economic trends and policies that impact you. So let me finish up with a background of the state spending trends, because I think you'll find this interesting. The first is, this is national total spending. This is incredible to me. Now, it's mostly because of the Recovery Act. Almost 35% of the funds that states are receiving is from the federal government. Now, that's going to decline dramatically once we phase out the Recovery Act funds. But less than 40% nationally are the general funds, which again are the general revenue sources like income and sales tax that are used for discretionary purposes such as K-12. Now, I wanted to show this to you as far as Minnesota. You are less dependent on those federal funds, and you have a higher percentage of your budget in general funds. That's all good. It means you have a little more discretion in making financial management decisions. It also means you're less dependent on the federal government. There are states, through no fault of their own, who will see downgrades in their bond rating, probably a Virginia or Maryland, solely because of their dependency on the federal government, if those funds decline over time. So the less dependent you are, the better from a long-term financial management standpoint you are as a percentage. Now, I'll be the first to say, if you can get money from the feds and you want it, then that's all, probably always a nice thing. Now, total state expenditures, what I want to emphasize here is the majority across the nation is Medicaid, K-12, and higher ed. What's interesting about this is what it shows in terms of trends. And Medicaid is higher than K-12 for the first time the last couple of years. And I would venture a guess that that's going to continue. And that tells you a lot. Now, if you look at the national general fund trend, an overwhelming majority is just K-12, higher ed, and Medicaid. Medicaid's running over 17%. That's a huge, the trajectory of that is a huge increase. Just about 10 years ago, it was something like 11 or 12. I mean, it's really, Medicaid is really, really spiking. Now, Minnesota, I thought this was really interesting. Your percentages for K-12, higher ed, and Medicaid, as far as what you spend, are higher than the national average. And I thought you'd find that very interesting. Medicaid a couple of points higher than the national average in particular. The other thing I want to show you, I show this slide because I want to show you that over the 10-year period, now we really only have the data through 11, so it's a bit dated, but it's a 10-year period, except for that area you call all other, which is parks and recreation, those types of things. You have increased spending year over year in every area, including higher education. Now, every other state's the percentages differ. Every other state looks like that. Everybody's increased spending year over year. I have to tell you kind of a funny thing. I was at a higher ed conference, and one of the guys got up and he said, this is the slide the college presidents don't like to see because it shows increased spending in higher ed. State spending from federal funds, what I wanted to show you here is in the average is about 43.5% on Medicaid for states, but let me show you Minnesota. You're over half of the federal funds you receive are Medicaid. Now, part of that, again, is you're less dependent in other areas, you're less dependent on federal funds based on the aggregate data. Now, I'll finish up with a couple of comments. One is, and you're going to hear a lot more about this during the rest of the day, so I'm certainly not the expert on this. But one thing, one real trend that we're seeing as we talk to budget officers is a focus on results and outcomes. To really ask for data about, is a program effective so you can spend money on effective programs. Now, the other part of that is improving management, efficiency, those types of things. And again, I think there are a lot of speakers who are going to talk about accountability and efficiency. My view is it is no longer appropriate to simply say, well, how much did Agency X get last year? And we have a little more money. Let's give them a little more money this year. Really ask those tough questions. Are they being effective? And they providing outcomes? Now, a little personal comment based on the work that I do in budgets. One of the things you hear all the time is, well, the data is bad. What are we going to do? We're having trouble getting good data. That's all true. So there are two parts to that. You try to improve the data and information. But secondly, at least again, it's a personal view, but my view is something's better than nothing. So if you have something that helps to inform the debate about whether to expend more or less on a particular program, it's helpful to try to answer those questions about, are you spending money on something that's effective? If it's a literacy program, are people really being taught to read? If it's a jobs program, are they getting jobs for people? So let me finish up with a quick outlook of what I've talked about today. State budgets are dependent on the economy, with the exception of those states on that map I showed you that are very dependent on energy. And that's you. So you're going to rise and fall with the national economy, and hopefully that'll continue to be on the right trajectory. Healthcare reform is going to have an impact. It's important to watch that and get good estimates of the cost impacts. There's going to be incredibly tough competition for all of those general funds. Everybody's going to be fighting K through 12, higher ed. Everybody's going to want that extra dollar. And you're going to be in an environment over the long term of limited and declining federal funds. And finally, and you're better than, frankly, some other states I speak to about this, finally, you do have to constantly be aware of what kind of long-term liabilities in terms of debt, pensions, and so forth. And again, you're better off than a lot of other states, but I've watched states very quickly lose sight of that and in a few years realize suddenly the balance sheet doesn't look so great because of liabilities, say, in pensions or something else. So that's important. So with that, we have a website, but I'm happy to talk to people afterwards or in Q&A to go. And I always joke if you have insomnia, you can go there and look at the data. Although I ended a talk, I was jet lagged, and I ended a talk the other day, and I said, if you have amnesia, check our data. And I couldn't figure out why not only I had blank stares, but then I got a great laugh. So thank you very much.
Well, while they make a few technical changes, thank you again for the opportunity. Can you hear me in the back?
Well, we can't get you in the recording.
So I'm good for the moment, but not perpetuity if I don't speak here. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. It's a pleasure. My name is Harley Duncan. I'm with KPMG out of our Washington National Tax Office. The reason I think I'm here anyway is that for the prior 20 years or for 30 years of my life, I've been in state government administration, particularly tax administration. And up until the last few years, I was the executive director of the Federation of Tax Administrators, which is the Association of State Revenue Departments. So I was the counterpart agency on the tax side to what Scott does on the budget side. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I grew up in South Dakota, so this is a little bit like at least coming close to home. The Twin Cities is where we came for sin and debauchery, so I enjoy coming back. It's also nice to do something at the Humphrey or with the Humphrey Institute. My grandparents lived in a small town in South Dakota named Dolan, South Dakota, which for the Humphrey historians, you'll recognize as his birthplace. So many an afternoon listening to my grandfather talk about young Hubert when he was growing up. So what I want to do in about 10 minutes is to try to put Minnesota taxes in the context of other states, try to give you a sense of where Minnesota taxes would stack up against other states, and do looking really at three pieces very quickly. One is sort of what is the mix of state and local taxes in Minnesota vis-a-vis the rest of the country, as well as some of the Great Lakes states. I didn't include the Dakotas because they are such an anomaly, but we look at some other Great Lakes states. So what's the state and local mix? What's the state tax mix? Then we take a little look at what's the burden in Minnesota versus some other states. And then what are some of the key structural characteristics and things that you might pay attention to? And there'll be information that that Kate and Professor Jacobson make available to you. This is all based on 2009 Census Bureau data, that being the most recent that we have. That slide just keeps me from getting fired when I do these things. So I'm gonna use the pictures and do it that way. So this is state and local taxes, Minnesota on the right, U.S. over on the left. And again, it's just a mix on the state and local tax side. Three points to keep in mind here, I think. One, Minnesota relies relatively less on the property tax than most other states. In other states, on average, it's a third. Minnesota, slightly less than 30%. Minnesota, second point, relies generally less on general sales taxes, that's your retail sales and use tax, not the whiskey, cigarette, and motor fuel side, but your general retail sales tax, less than a fifth in Minnesota, nearly a quarter in the other states on average. Yeah, obviously, everybody has to equal 100, so where do we get to 100 in Minnesota? No surprise to you, I suspect. That is, Minnesota relies relatively more heavily on the individual income tax than other states on average. About 30% in Minnesota, closer to 20% in the rest of the country. If we take a look and try to do that same comparison on the Great Lakes states, trying to multitask here. So what do we find here? Well, again, and we're looking at Michigan, Iowa, Indiana, Illinois, and compared in Wisconsin compared to Minnesota. Again, basically the same pattern. Minnesota less reliant on the property tax than the other states, and in fact is the lowest of the states. Only really Indiana down there in the same zone, about 30%. Most of the other states in this region up in the 35 and approaching 40%. Minnesota less reliant on sales tax than the region, less than 20% compared to about a quarter, 25% in the other states in the region. Again, the difference gets picked up on the individual income tax side. If we look at, state taxes only, and in compared to the U.S., you see the same pattern emerging. The individual income tax dominates in Minnesota much more so than the other states on the whole. This is just state taxes only. The sales tax is the basic swing tax. The rest of the states, the rest of the taxes, sales tax, excuse me, the selective sales tax, that's your excise taxes, motor fuel, corporate income, other taxes, all about the same. The basic distinguishing characteristic Minnesota compared to other states is indeed in the reliance on the individual income tax versus reliance on the sales tax. You look at the property, excuse me, the local taxes only, there's a very distinguishing characteristic here. The only thing essentially that you allow local governments to use as a tax base in Minnesota is the property tax dominates. It's something right around 95%. I think the number is 93% of all local tax revenues come from the property tax. A more varied mix in the other states in the country, particularly on the general sales tax. Out of the 46 states with the general sales tax, there's about 30 to 35, something in the low 30s, that generally allow local governments to access the sales tax and allow a relatively wide, large number of local governments to use the sales tax. That's not the case in Minnesota. It's changed a bit in recent years, but relatively small number of jurisdictions have access to the sales tax, and that's what accounts for this picture. This is state taxes compared to the other Great Lakes states. Two things stand out. One, and it's not a huge thing, but Minnesota does still use the property tax at the state level to some degree. Only Michigan does that in this region. And again, it's really income tax in Minnesota versus sales tax in the other. This is state taxes only, so Wisconsin begins to look more like Minnesota with something on the order of 40% reliance on individual income taxes. It's about the same as Minnesota. Same with Iowa. The other states, though, the Indianas in Michigan in particular, the greater reliance on the sales tax. So that's kind of the mix of things. If we look at tax burden, what I looked at here is just state and local taxes measured against personal income, as just using personal income as the best proxy we have for what's the economic base that underlays the state system. Don't worry about all the lines going crisscross and some of the numbers looking, or the colors looking the same. Look at the two fat lines. The two fat lines are Minnesota is the red, and the U.S. average is the blue. This is state and local taxes as a percent of personal income. You see a very distinguishing characteristic. It goes from 1977 through 2009. 1977 through about 2000, 2002, Minnesota was significantly in excess of the U.S. average, something in excess of maybe 12% of personal income in state and local taxes, compared to about a 10.5% in the U.S. as a whole. Since the 2000 and 2002 zone, there's been a real convergence both in the state and local, for the U.S. moving up some, Minnesota dropping down and leveling off at right about 10.9%, so that at this point in time, relatively little difference between the U.S. average and the Minnesota average in state and local taxes as a percent of personal income. This is just looking at the same thing, but only for state taxes. And here you see state taxes in Minnesota running higher than state taxes on average in the rest of the country. That's just given that your overall tax burden is about the same, but state tax burden is up. It's just another way of saying Minnesota finances a greater proportion of its overall state and local system through state taxes and runs it out of state government, as opposed to relying on the local governments and particularly the property tax. So greater proportion of financing here in Minnesota at the state level. There's some charts in here on some basic structural characteristics of corporate income, personal income, and your sales and use tax. I think there are three quick points I'll make, and we can talk about them. One, your corporate tax looks pretty much like the other corporate taxes in the region. If I looked at one thing that stands out, the rate is higher. The way you structure it, the base, some of the other things that go into what we tax nerds look at on a corporate side, all look pretty plain vanilla compared to the rest of the region. The rate would be one thing that stands up and it would distinguish you a bit. Individual income tax side, that which distinguishes you again is the rate, but as well the base here, and in particular the phasing out of exemptions and deductions based on income. Is a different feature than is present in the others. You also have the Illinois, Indiana, pretty much flat gross, adjusted gross income taxes. Then on the sales tax side, I think the distinguishing characteristic here, two things to pay attention to. One, with both food and clothing being exempt in Minnesota as compared to food only in the rest, the base is somewhat narrower than in the other states, which accounts for some of that lower reliance on sales taxes, as well as then the lesser use of the sales tax by the local governments. The other thing I think that would bear some looking in Minnesota is the extent to which the sales tax is imposed on business inputs and capital inputs, machinery, equipment, utilities used in the production process. So I think that's kind of what the information that I had. If I, you know, to draw everything out of Minnesota, but really it's a little bit like Garrison Keillor, and all the children are above average if you look at your tax system compared to others in the region. They're not significantly sharp differences. You can should be thinking maybe about some rates. Maybe is the base somewhat narrow, is your mix right, those sorts of things. But we used to evaluate tax policy on the convoy theory. You don't want to be the ship that's way out in front and have some anomaly that makes you very different and causes you to be way out in front or way behind, because then you get shot at, right? Well, I think you've kind of hit it. It's pretty much in the middle, and you're in the middle of the convoy when it comes to tax structure, mix, and burden. Thank you.
Well, this could be good news or bad news. I don't have a PowerPoint. Part of that was that I wanted to talk to you, and not I'm going to give you a few of the data that we look at, but I really wanted to talk about what we see. I'm the current chair of the Governor's Workforce Development Council, which is our state workforce investment board mandated under the Workforce Investment Act. So that's the board, and in this state we call it the GWDC. I've been on that board for 8 years. And was just in June appointed to chair the board. Our board is very large. We have about 34 members, both sides of the aisle. The commissioners of the departments that touch workforce development in any way are on the board. Chancellor of MinSCU system, who you're going to hear from later today, the president of the University of Minnesota, some private school members attend our board meetings but aren't currently a voting part of the board. Our largest number is business. The executive committee is made up of business representatives and the leaders of the state agencies that are engaged in workforce development. We're a policy board. We are charged with watching what does our state need in terms of workforce development policy and how do we recommend that we get in line with those needs. I have spent 12 years, now my day job is for Elite, also known, better known in Minnesota as Minnesota Power, an energy company whose customers are not only people like you and I, but a lot of large industry in the northern part of the state. That's my day job. The other part of my job, though, is my volunteer service to Minnesota, to my community initially, and now to the state, looking at workforce development. In 12 years, I have tried to figure out our workforce development system. Now, I'm not the brightest bulb, but I should have found it a little easier. This is so complex. It's one of the issues that doesn't work well about WEA, quite frankly, is that WEA says every state board and every local board will be led by business. But business is so frustrated with trying to understand how they have any impact that this is difficult. I happen to work for an employer that supports my involvement, and so I've been at the local level, the regional level, now chairing our state board, and I'm on the executive board for the national group of state boards of workforce investment boards. And one of the things that we talk about a lot is scratch our head and say, how does it all fit together? So I just have a great deal of empathy for how you try to figure out how it all fits together. I'm sure by now you certainly have heard folks talking about the skills gap in the country as well as in Minnesota. One of the reasons that more business is coming to the table to try to figure it out and have these conversations is that we're scared. My business is deeply concerned about the skills gap. And we have, as you saw, it was great to follow Scott and Harley because they gave you a great deal of data about unemployment and some of the issues that around taxation and that business is talking about. But we have some of the lowest unemployment, and yet two-thirds of our employers in the last 6 months have reported difficulty filling skilled jobs. Did you know, for us at the energy company where I'm in charge of talent acquisition and development, it can cost us an additional $25,000 to $50,000 to bring in a technically skilled person to work for us in northeastern Minnesota. By the time we find them, and there's not a whole lot of people that want to move north, those that do, guess where they're moving? North Dakota. So we are really in a competitive state for technical skills. We have brought in some two-year trained, technically skilled folks from Alaska in the last 6 months in order to fill jobs that we desperately need. We have had to find welders and machinists and other two-year and less skilled employees from other states and convince them to move north. Less of the U.S. population is moving for work right now. It's harder to get them to move, and it's costing us a lot more to get them there. So why are we having this gap? Well, I don't know if you've seen the statistics, but we've got about 3.1 million available adults to go to work in our workforce today that are available. Of that 3.1 million in Minnesota, 2 million of them do not come with any credential to do a job. They're hardworking, they've got good values, many of them are wonderful in every other way, but they don't come with any sort of post-secondary skill credential. Of the 2 million that I'm talking about, over 800,000 of them have not completed high school in Minnesota. Are those shocking to you? They were shocking to me when I began to see what we're up against. So two-thirds of our adults today, according to the demographers and the numbers that we're being told at the Workforce Council, that two-thirds of the individuals that are out there, the majority of which don't have a skilled credential today, they're going to represent two-thirds of the workforce in 2020. They're still going to represent more than half of the workforce in 2030 because we're also in an aging state, faster than we're replacing those of us that are aging out. So we do have a skills gap here, and what we as business are very concerned about is how do we fight it on two fronts? We need to do better in our K-12 system to prepare students to enter our post-secondary. Later today, you're going to hear some of the challenges from Chancellor Rosenstone and President Kaler about what they're looking at, that our public school systems, our post-secondary, are getting a lot of folks that want to get in and get a credential that need developmental assistance in order to even begin. So we have to do it all. We have to address the K-12 system. We have to address how are we going to skill up our available workforce today. So that's where I want to center my comments. So how do we see that we stay competitive? Well, one thing that we need to do is to realize that it takes two to tango in this. You know, we've focused a great deal on economic development and incentives, and I've been on the Minnesota Job Skills Board. I've served up in our Northeast region with attempts to draw new business, new employers to Minnesota to fill empty spaces left by Northwest and others. We've done that, and what happens so many times is that we offer wonderful packages and incentives, and they take a look around and they say, but where would we find 300 people with the skills that we need to start to work here if we moved into this beautiful space? That's our issue right now in northeastern Minnesota. And there are other places where we've brought business in, and 2 years later, they're coming to the Governor's Workforce Development Council, and I'm sure to some of you, and saying, if I had any idea that it was going to be this hard to get skilled workers to grow or to replace the workers who are leaving, I would have thought differently. Have any of you heard those messages? Okay. So the Governor's Workforce Development Council takes in the 34 of us, and we take in all the information that comes our way, and we try to say, what would impact this? And we've decided that there are really three things that we need to do. And the two to tango idea is that we have to balance and work together better between our economic development efforts and our workforce development efforts, because one without the other, either way, isn't going to get us where Minnesota needs to go. So on the GWDC, we see basically three issues that need to be addressed. One is alignment. And you're going to hear some more about that today, and I'm going to talk a little more about it in a moment. Two is the notion of measuring outcomes instead of outputs. We have an entire system, multiple systems, for years that we have measured outputs on, the numbers served, the numbers enrolled, the numbers that came through our doors, instead of outcomes. And we have to be able to look at the return on investment issue. And then the third thing that we absolutely have to do in this state is that we need to get about getting people credentials. And credentials to go to work are everything from a certificate that says they can weld 1-inch thick material competently in order to work in one of our large industrial manufacturing plants. It could be that they need a 2-year certificate in electronic technology to run our rapidly increasing, more complex systems and equipment in our plants, or it could be a 4-year degree in engineering, which we're desperately needing to get more of, or an advanced degree, and teachers to replace behind those that are leaving. All levels, we need to focus on credentials. Business is not sitting out there saying that our greatest need is 4-year credentials in all areas. Lots of Minnesota business needs people that can go to work much quicker. So those three areas, alignment, outcomes, and credentials. In terms of alignment, we're making significant progress in this state, and a lot of those conversations go on through the GWDC and our subcommittees. But we need to better align our resources. We need to better align our agencies and how they do this work together so that one isn't doing the opposite another one is doing. We need to come together to be able to serve individuals in a new way in Minnesota, and that's really going to require a lot of us flexing to do things differently than we've done in the past. We need to be able to explain how we're doing it to folks that want to get engaged in a manner that makes sense. It's just too complex. How do we do it and describe it more simply? We really need all state agencies to get behind the same strategy. We need a strategy and a goal for how we're going to solve the skills gap, and we need everybody set and in that direction. The one that's looming in the next 6 years, have you seen the Carnevale study on out of Georgetown University? It says that looking at Minnesota and where we are and where we're growing, in 6 years, 70% of our jobs are going to require a post-secondary education. Today, little less than 40% of our adults have that to offer. So we need to get aligned behind a goal and get into developing our workforce. Secondly, the outcome issue, and I'm not going to say a whole lot about that. We have a committee that's working on return on investment through the GWDC. You're going to hear more about that in the coming months. I know that later this morning you're going to hear more from Peter and Steve about outcome measurement. But we absolutely need to get to the place, and I think Scott mentioned that too, that we've got to be looking at funding effective programs and making sure that we have a way to know that. That has been a question that has been very difficult for most of us on the GWDC. And then the third issue of credentials. We need folks everything from credentials they can get in 12 weeks to credentials that may take them 6 years. We need all of the educational systems post-secondary to figure out a way to deliver some of the longer term credentials quicker. The current system that we have works great for 18 to 20 year olds that don't have to work, but an increasing number of those need to work in order to go to school because of the cost. Our system doesn't work well for that 2 million Minnesotans that I'm talking about that we need to get engaged. We need to realign so that we can get a 2 year program credential with all of the same quality in 12 months instead of 24. We need to align some of our shorter term programs to do it quicker too. Adults need to go to school like they go to work. Get it done. Get it good, have quality, but get it done. So those are the big issues that we see, and I'll welcome some conversation from you and your ideas, and I encourage you to go to gwdc.org if you have not seen our All Hands on Deck report. It addresses the three items I've talked about and others that we believe we need to embrace. Thanks.
Well, thank you to all of our panelists for opening comments, and now it is the interactive part. So I saw some of you writing down question and answers. If you have them, of course, Phyllis, you were first. Actually, I have one question actually to start off, and maybe we can have somebody volunteer. Who are the teacher's assistants in the class? Oh, look at that. Carol, Terry, of course. Kate. One of the questions to follow up with and as his comments, when it comes to, we're really good at making sure that the kids, you know, take a pre-calc class or, you know, Algebra 101 before, while they're in high school. One of the experiences I had in Maple Grove Senior High, we do mock interviews and interviewed a young gentleman, and he said, "Look, dude, I'm not going to college. I'm working in a body shop. I want to own the body shop in 10 years. He goes, "Can we just skip this whole college interview? And can you," he goes, "you're married, right?" I said, "Yep." "You got a house?" "Yep." "So he probably bought a car." "So yeah." He goes, "Look, I'm gonna have to go to a banker and get a loan. Can we do that instead of doing a college interview?" Which I thought was remarkable for a high school senior, but he was already on his path. What about, instead of just the post-secondary going on to a four-year college, what about technical, you know, in school, in high school, technical training? Is that something you see around the country? And is that something that, you know, maybe Scott, too, from your perspective, from a budgetary standpoint, you know, looking at the workforce development, is that something that we should also be introducing, not just, you know, get your first semester of your four-year degree out of the way in high school, but some of those technical college training as well?
Yes, definitely. I mean, that the majority of jobs right now that are going unfilled are in the technical and community college arena. I think that one thing we need to do is redefine college. We use that term, and everybody thinks that we're always talking about four-year or advanced degree, and we need both. And so the idea is that we are sending many students on to get college credits to go on for four-year and higher degrees from the high schools. We need to have programs, and we do have some programs in Minnesota that are doing the same for the individuals like you're talking about that really want to move into very quickly into some technical or labor area and move forward with their life. And we're not doing a particularly good job of doing that. We've got about one counselor to help with careers for over 850 high school students in Minnesota. I mean, it's desperate to have those resources. There are very, very few visible to adults once they're out of high school.
Scott?
Well, and I'll just say real quick, I think the problem in terms of when you look at budgeting is, and I realize there are a lot of political and controversial issues involving K through 12 and higher ed, but what seems to happen is in budgeting is something sounds like a good idea, and then you add a little line item and a little bit of additional money when you have it for the program. What doesn't happen is going back and opening and look under the hood of all K through 12 and all higher ed state spending and say, is this aligned with the goals that we want in terms of workforce development and other important state goals? And that tends to not occur. I realize there are politics with that, but that's something that a real rethinking of aligning the spending with the ultimate state goals is important.
Sure, Inez?
Well, I just want to say, I shared that I sit with the chairs of other workforce boards across the country. Minnesota is seen as a leader, and we are a leader in many programs that are accidental. No, they're not accidental. I guess they're random acts of excellence that are going on, a program here, a program there that's working. Sustaining those programs is becoming increasingly difficult. Expanding them is extremely difficult. And that's where the outcome measurement and looking at using our money wisely comes in. We need to look at where it is working and where we are seen as having some leadership that we can teach to other states and expanding that into a way of doing business across our state.
Great. Harley, it met in. Otherwise, we'll go to next question.
You can go to the next question.
Okay. I'll start with long-term learning accounts are one way for today's employers' employees to save money, furthering their training and education, similar to 529 accounts. Any thoughts on this?
You want to talk about the financial end? Oh, you're going to give that to me?
Yeah. If not, I messed up as a moderator picking the hardest question for the panel. All right, we'll move on to the next. If you want, otherwise, we can edit for comments here for selection for the group. Otherwise, I can go on to the next question, too.
The only thing from an informed perspective that I can say is that I'm personally on a mission of trying to get more employers to look at tuition programs for folks that once they do get in the door, that we can help them be lifelong learners. Because our business is changing so fast, we need employees to continue to learn as they go through their career. So getting more of us to have scholarship programs and tuition is very important. I think that 529 and other funds for learning are great as well.
And I think the only thing there is that some of these programs are not at least general fund costs, but they do involve costs, and I think it's important to look at what any program like that you're putting together, what are the potential costs. But again, it goes back to what we've been talking about too. If you implement them, are they really being effective? Are they reaching the goal that you want? That has to be looked at.
This is maybe back to employment or unemployment, which we, Scott pointed out, we're far better at. Why, when showing unemployment rates, analysts throw out the number of, I'm assuming this is supposed to be underemployed or unemployed, who have quit looking for jobs, aren't they, or should they say they are just as unemployed as the remaining unemployed still looking for jobs? So it's the unemployed versus underemployment question.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, yeah, that's one of those data issues that comes up a lot. The federal government, in terms of the overall unemployment rate, has chosen not to include those folks, although you are seeing more so than I think ever actual attempts to get at what those numbers are. And often I know the news media is now reporting both
what they believe is the total overall unemployment rate, as well as the way the federal government defines it as those who are looking.
And we absolutely need to do that. There are way too many dislocated workers in this state that are a part of those 2 million adults that need to skill up that have given up looking.
And how do you see when the extension of unemployment benefits, so as we get to the end of that extended, when those maybe underemployed start coming back onto the rolls, do you see is there going to be a big bubble, or is it going to shoot up? How will it affect some of those numbers, and what will it mean, I guess probably on workforce development, but especially on, maybe a depressing factor when we see all of a sudden the unemployment rate jump 5 points?
Well, I don't think the unemployment rate as they measure it today will, because once they fall off unemployment, they're not in that data. We're trying to talk about it now, but we don't have an effective way to capture individuals that are no longer getting dislocated workers support or unemployment.
Well, and I just want to add, too, that if you look at the economic forecast for the next few years, one of the reasons that unemployment is not expected to go way down is exactly that reason. You're going to have, so there'll be a, the data won't demonstrate the positive nature of what's happening with more people coming back to work, exactly because you are going to have those who weren't looking come back into the market, and that will keep that rate high. Of course, that it's difficult to determine on an individual basis the extent to which that will occur, but I know economic forecasts are trying to get a feel for that.
I think we've already seen that sort of phenomenon in several months of where you have reasonable job growth, but you still have the unemployment rate bounces up a tick or two, and it's really people coming back in, and that's what part of what Scott said keeps the projected rate high relative to historic averages over the next few years.
This one's for Scott. Is there any data which, and I apologize if your writing is, if I stumble on the question, and if it's your question, feel free to ask if I mess up because of penmanship. Apparently there are doctors in the room. Is there any data which tells how state budgets are recovering or improved by the type of budget solutions used, i.e. all cuts budget, all taxes budget, combo budget, cuts and revenue and reform, more rapid recovery, slower recovery, et cetera?
That's a great question. And what we found over the years is it takes several years to get through the process and then look back. So a good example is the post 9/11 downturn period. We really didn't understand a lot of what had happened there until we looked back and looked at the data several years later. That's what's going on now. And as kind of a green eye shades wonk, to me it's very exciting. The bad part is a lot of the answers we won't know at this moment. But I'd say in a year or two, as we continue to analyze the data, we'll know more. For example, this summer, I know my group, the association, is actually going to do a project to analyze how the different states dealt with the downturn and try to compare and contrast as to what types of things worked, didn't work, what kind of lessons did we learn. But unfortunately, we won't have it in a snapshot moment.
Are you sure? We could really use the help if you wouldn't mind. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, having looked at these things for a long time, there's really only two places you can go for information on these questions. And one is the series that Scott's group does. It's called the Fiscal Survey of the States, you do in the spring and the winter. And then the other is the Conference of State Legislatures. And they, out of the Denver office, puts out a report on state budget and state taxes. And they do it three times?
Yeah.
I think Karina and Arturo do it three times a year. And it is the most comprehensive. It comes from state people. It is consistent across time, and it has no polemics involved with it. So it's as good as you're going to get for information.
Harley, Timely, you're up next. The Minnesota corporate rate is higher than other upper Midwestern states. Have any of those states reduced corporate tax expenditures and used the revenue to, assuming it's lower corporate tax rates, would you recommend doing this here in Minnesota? No pressure. If you want to write a bill right here, we've got several folks that'll co-author, maybe some that won't touch it. But
when I talked to the people at the firm about coming out here, they said, you won't recommend anything, correct? And I said, absolutely correct.
Ever thought about a career in politics?
No, certainly not. On the tax expenditure side and what states have done, I'm trying to think. A couple of years ago, Wisconsin made as big a move as anybody in this area on the where they instituted what we call combined reporting. This is, or unitary in the corporate world. Minnesota has long had that. Illinois has long had that. Michigan has traditionally used it as well. Wisconsin did not. There is a debate among people as to whether combined reporting increases money, revenues, or decreases revenues. It depends on the taxpayer, and it depends on where you are in the economic cycle. But they contended that it did raise some money in Wisconsin and did use the rate to reduce rates somewhat. Iowa considered it, but did not adopt it. I'm thinking, and I'm not aware of anything else where there was a wide, a fairly comprehensive look at expenditures on the corporate side and trying to use that to pay down rates. But we may see more of that this year as monitoring legislation, there's probably a dozen states that have proposed some reductions in the corporate rate to be financed either out of what they consider to be current revenues or through some base actions, but there hasn't been a lot in the last few years.
For Inez, comment on ABE, adult basic education, into community colleges and aligning with workforce programs into community colleges. In 20 minutes or less.
Yeah, 20 minutes or less. Great question. We've done a lot of work with ABE. We have a program. It's a model to be used, not a specific program, called the Minnesota Fast Track. And the model has proven to get an 88% success rate in the early times. And we have those random places where it's working around the state that has ABE playing a larger role in helping adults to get post-secondary credential for jobs.
Great. I see my colleague Senator Bach is in the room, so we'll maybe, you guys have done a great job. We have way more questions than we have time for, so we'll maybe do two more questions real quickly, and then we'll submit these questions to our panelists. If they'd like, they'll send an email back to me. I can send it on to everybody at the legislature, or we'll have Larry figure out a way, or Kate probably actually will figure out a way to get everybody the answers to the questions we appreciate. This is one I think probably timely for this panel, but also for some of the coming panels. Is there any state that has a really good results, cost-benefit analysis, information-based exercise where you can link an increase/decrease in spending to an increase/decrease in results? I guess we're looking to hijack somebody's good idea and make it better in Minnesota.
Yeah, the answer to that is no, but everybody's aspiring to that, which I think is good. So what I tell folks is there's no nirvana out there. There's no one particular state to look to. There are a whole variety of states that do certain aspects of results and performance-based budgeting well, but no one does everything terrific in terms of including cost-benefit analysis, aligning the money with the goals. But everybody's aspiring to that. Mm-hmm. So I really do think it's important. I would look at a state like Washington, Oregon, Iowa, Virginia, that there are aspects of this going on, and I think the nice thing is that all 50 states are aspiring in some way to that goal.
Great. And this is, we'll close up with this, and again, we have a number of questions. Thanks, everybody, for lively discussion, but great questions. And this goes back to our technical training, and I'll maybe hybrid the question a little bit, but we have a pool of technically trained veterans experienced in high unemployment rates. What can we do to better transition that demographic into areas of labor demand, especially in the technical fields you referred to? So maybe some of our veterans that are either good welders or field trained in how to get a tank or a truck back up and running, put up structure, how best to transition them. Maybe it's an expedited process for that certificate, something along those lines to put them in quickly because of the work they've done, probably over in the field or in the battlefield.
It is exactly that. And we're working both nationally in the energy industry a lot, but also other industries are working nationally and in the state. It does come down to helping to measure what skills they already have and give them credit in terms of acknowledgement that they have that skill, and giving them the rest that they need very quickly so that they can come into our jobs.
Fantastic. Well, we've got, we're a little bit over. Oh, and we got, I didn't even get to half the question, so way to go, you guys. We told you it'd be a good panel, right? We welcome you to Minnesota. We will have a brief, we're not going to leave the room because I know what happens when people get up and leave a room. If you will, stand up next to your neighbor. For those of us who are Lutherans, this is as close to we get as a motion in church, but stand up, turn around, shake hands with your neighbor, get a little blood flowing. We'll get Senator Bach up here, get our panelists down, but thank you, a warm thank you to our panelists.